bidding for Friday, April 20th. And just to let folks know, we're going to start with the work session portion of our agenda, and then we will do the public hearing for 26, 28, and 838. Regarding 2564, there's an amendment, the dash twos. Is that right? So we're going to be having a hearing on only the dash twos of the 2564 because the original bill is no longer valid. The dash twos are a replacement of 2564. We will be putting copies out there in just a few minutes. So I'm going to start with a work session on House Bill 3469. Kat, can you provide us with a little background information on that, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3469 authorizes the Department of Human Services to grant variances from certain water treatment techniques required under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act when treatment is unnecessary for protecting public health.
Okay, and we don't have any amendments to this bill, so I would entertain a motion.
You need a motion,
yes, please. I guess we're missing. Hold on, we are missing several of our members, so
I'll hold tight.
Wanted to pull.
Let's see if Billy is out in the hall, please.
We'll be at ease until we find. Oh, here he is. We're just about to vote or have a motion on House Bill 3469.
Madam Chair.
Oh, actually, I'm sorry. You want to make a motion? Go ahead.
Sure. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3469 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Great. Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Smith moves House Bill 3469 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? This is the variance bill that we heard lots of input on. Okay. Those of the opinion that House Bill 3469 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. Motion passes, and I'm going to ask Representative Burley if he'd like to carry the bill.
I'd be delighted, Madam Chair.
Okay. So House Bill 3469 moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and Representative Burley will be the carrier. Thank you. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3469. And I think we're going to try to find what's going to sound like. Is that right? Actually, what I'd like to do is the Forest Park one first. So, is Tom here? Representative Greenlick's office?
He's probably close.
Okay, we've got, we'll stand at ease for a minute. We have two bills that another representative would like to come testify or give a few comments on. And so, we will open up a work session on House Bill 2960 here in a minute. Very sensitive microphones up here.
Sorry.
Well, what I'll do is I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2960. Is there anybody here that would like to add anything to 2960? Okay. We'll wait for Representative Greenlick and we'll entertain a motion.
Are you looking for a motion, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll make a motion.
He doesn't have to be here for a move of this bill.
I move, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2960 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative.
Oh, and I think it does have a subsequent referral, doesn't it?
Yes. To the Ways and Means Committee.
Yeah.
Not subsequent.
All right.
We're adding it.
I better get this right.
It didn't have it originally on there.
And be referred.
Okay, I'm going to repeat the motion.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2960 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Representative Cannon has made a motion to move House Bill 2960 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion?
Just real quick, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really want to compliment Representative Greenlick on bringing forward House Bill 2960. I think the concept behind this is solid, and I guess I would just want to put on the record that I'd hope the Ways and Means Committee would give this a strong look. Quite often, bills sent to Ways and Means are the death yard for legislation, and I would hope that wouldn't be the case with 2960.
Thank you, Representative Smith. I'm just wondering if DLCD is in the room anywhere, or they're hiding. Bob, would you want to come up and just talk about, since there was a referral added to the Ways and Means Committee, if you can maybe talk a little bit about that and what that will entail? I mean, for those of us on the Ways and Means Committee, you may be hearing that directly, but I think it's important for the committee that they hear about the referral.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. We worked with Representative Green last session and fixed several things and that made us comfortable with this bill. So we are in favor of it. However, our position has been that there is a fiscal, and we don't know exactly what that is, since the bill requires us to reimburse all local government costs. What we did is ask Metro whether they would coordinate all the local governments that would do this work and give us an estimate of their costs, and that's a large part of the fiscal that you see. And I think that's probably the best way to do the coordination, since there are a number of local governments. And as I've indicated, we are... otherwise, we have no concerns about the bill. We note that the bill does require that the funds that would be paid to local governments be drawn from the grant fund, the general fund grants that are provided to DLCD for periodic review, which we subsequently deliver those to local governments for periodic review. So to the extent that this fiscal, that the cost in this bill, the estimate is correct, that will be money that is currently in our budget, or would be in our budget for next biennium for periodic review, that would be subtracted from periodic review and would be assigned to this function.
Okay. Any questions for the department?
Yes.
Okay, and welcome, Representative Greenlick. I'm sorry we got started because we've got a full agenda today, so appreciate you being here. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for not having been at the hearing on this before, so I just very quickly, Mr. Rindy, would you please explain what exactly is an area of critical state concern?
Chair Dinkler, Representative Burley, I wish I knew exactly. At this point, there are none. The statute, I think since Senate Bill 100 was enacted in 72, I think it's been there that long as a possibility that LCDC could recommend to the legislature that an area of the state be designated by the legislature as an area of critical state concern. And I think it's a broad provision under which the legislature could then provide specific regulations or funding or other programs to address that area of statewide concern. I think when there has been, over the years, there's been discussion about other areas that might be areas of state concern, such as the Gorge, but never, there's no instance where LCDC has ever made such a recommendation, so we don't have any previous experience with this.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Greenlick, with all due respect to my very good friend and neighbor on the fourth floor, I'm going to be a no vote on this bill simply because I'm just not comfortable with what we're doing here. Not knowing what it
is. Let me comment on it, if I might, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. The issue of Forest Park is an issue we don't need to talk about substantively. What I'm trying to do is to, it's been protected for the last 100 years in ways that really make a lot of sense, and I'm trying to look forward to the next 100. The problem is that right now it's a larger area of Forest Park, Greater Forest Park, which includes the watershed, the game trails in from the coastal mountains, the summer and winter range for the large mammals that are in Forest Park, the elk, the deer, cougar, other things, is the jurisdiction of several different governmental agencies. So the planning for this area, it gets kind of confused between Metro, the city of Portland, which has the park itself, the existing park, and its current boundaries, Multnomah County and Washington County, and maybe some other special districts get involved in that, like some of the parks things. And there's no clear way to determine who's responsible for thinking about this area as a future area. So when we search for ways, not wanting to try and create a new state park or other kinds of things, we search for ways to get some overview into this whole process, and we came across this area of special state concern, which has in fact never been used. And in the bill 2 years ago, when I tried to name it an area of special state concern. Well, that's kind of hopeless, since you don't know what an area of special state concern is and what the consequences of what that would be. So the way we drafted the bill this time, and it has no opposition now from Metro, the city, the county, either of the counties, the state department, is to say, well, let's look at the issue and let's see whether we can create something in this definition of an area of special state concern or something else that will help us move forward with the ability to coordinate and to plan in a coordinated way for this rather complex set of lands. And that's where we came upon that, and that's where that came. So the question for LCDC, I guess, not DLCD, is to think about what an area of special state concern could be. As I say, the areas that have been proposed for it is the coast first, and that was handled by a special guideline, Smith Rock, Representative Smith's place over there. No, maybe it's not quite as far east as you go, and the gorge and others. So,
right.
So the question is to find out what it does mean, what the consequences of doing it this way might be, or how else you might achieve whatever objectives this joint group thinks would be logical objectives. So, no, we don't know what it is.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Okay, with that, I will entertain a motion.
I think you...
Oh, we have one on the table. I'm sorry. So, without, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Yes. Aye.
Representative Fire, excuse. Representative Jensen, excuse. Representative Burley?
No.
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Aye. Got the motion carries, and the bill will then move down to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And do I need to assign a carrier? No, they do that in Ways and
you
Means.
Don't need to.
So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2960. And I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3525. And colleagues, since two of our members are out today, we're going to postpone that work session until next week. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3525 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2628. And Kat, would you like to read the overview? And then we'll have Representative Greenwick, since it's his bill, also give an introduction.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2628, the bill as drafted restricted certain kinds of outdoor lighting. However, there's been a gut and stuff amendment to that bill, and that's what's under consideration today. That takes a different approach than the previous bill, and I think Rep. Greenlick and his staff are going to give us the explanation of that.
Thank you, Kat, and Representative. Everybody hopefully has a copy of the amendment in front of them.
If I can ask my staff to... You here? Yeah.
Tom, would you like to come up?
Tom, are you here? Yeah. Would you sort of join me at the
witness
stand? And thank you for letting me
be
here. Although
I'm almost
ready to go back down there.
Does everybody have a copy of the amendment? And this is the dash ones, is
dash
that correct?
Ones. Dash
okay.
Ones.
Okay. Tom or whoever would like to start.
Can I start? Yes. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which includes Northwest Portland, everything west to almost the coastal mountains, but not quite. This bill came about as a bit of personal experience for me. One day I was standing outside at the coast on a dark night without any lights around and looked up and saw a sky that I had forgotten that it had actually been there. I remember seeing it from my youth, but all of a sudden I looked up and saw the millions of stars and celestial objects that makes up. I could see the Milky Way in a way that I hadn't seen the Milky Way for 30 years. And I just looked at the sky and I said to myself, this is really very odd. And then I went home, and I live up on a hill in the West Hills, and looked up, and it was a nice clear night and the new moon, and I could see three planets and the moon and maybe some other stuff back there a little bit behind it. And I thought to myself, there are so many kids around here that are going to grow up and never see the sky. So I got interested in the question of light pollution in a way that I had never been interested before, and I started asking around, and I found there were places like Sandy and Tucson, Arizona, that had light pollution ordinances, and I visited with them, and I found that not only does light pollution dim the skies for a generation of city kids, but it also is very wasteful of energy. It costs a lot. The problem being, if you need to get light on the ground, say in a church parking lot or in some other public area, the way we currently deal with that is we put up a really bright omnidirectional lighting fixture that sends light in every direction, sends it up in the sky, and also sends too much light down onto the ground, which then reflects up into the sky again. And that it costs about twice as much in energy to use a lighting fixture like that than when will you determine how much light you need to have on the ground and an efficient way to get unidirectional light down onto the ground where you need to create light. So this isn't about dimming parking lots that need to have light for safety. This is about how do you efficiently get light onto the ground and to save all the energy that it takes to get twice as much light onto the ground and light everywhere else in addition to where you're trying to light. This is one more bill that I stumbled into as an amateur, a complete rank amateur, and didn't know anything about. I now knew the problem, but I didn't know anything about how to do it. And in the last session, we had a bill in that talked about, well, in the first session I addressed this, we had a bill that directed the Department of Transportation to create more efficient lighting for the parking lots and the freeways. ODOT came to me and said, you know, we've already done this. We've got a task force that's been working on it 3 years. Here's the standards we have. We don't need a bill to tell us to do it. We've already done it. So the next session I put in a bill about building codes and seeing if we could get the state building codes to change for outdoor lighting. I was getting constituent. By then it was known that I was interested in this. I was getting constituent messages about how I'm on the fourth floor of an apartment and we can't darken the apartment anyway. And I said, okay, well, let's deal with building codes. I changed that a bit this year and put it in, and it turned out a bunch of people came to me and said, you know, you're not the only one thinking about this. There's a group, it's on section 2 of page 2 of the amendments. There's a group called the International Dark Sky Association and the Illuminating Engineering Society of North America that are working on a model ordinance. So what we've amended this bill to do is to get, we thought, well, maybe first it was, I'm not sure which department. Which department first?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the department is the Department of Energy.
And you are?
And I'm Tom Powers, for the record, legislative assistant.
So first it was another department, but then the Department of Energy said, hey, we're interested in this anyway. We're going to do this anyway. We're interested in this problem. And we amend the bill here then basically all the bill does is it basically says the Department of Energy should watch for this ordinance, which will be out, we expect, in the next few months, take it into account, think about how it fits into the state plan, and report to us about findings and recommendations of where the state ought to go in terms of this new uniform amendment, uniform code. And Mr. Powers will talk through the amendments, at least briefly.
Briefly.
Very briefly. Let me just go through the amendments on the very first few paragraphs. These are kind of grounding for why we're doing this. These were whereas clauses that had been in previous versions of the bill, trying to explain the issue of dark sky and why this is considered a threat and why legislation might be necessary. Section 1 says that the Legislative Assembly wants to take action about this, and we're trying to accomplish some sort of model standard for outdoor lighting fixtures. Section 2 anticipates the release of such an ordinance between the collaboration of the International Dark Sky Association and the Illuminating Engineering Society of North America, and recommends that the Department of Energy anticipate and, upon its release, review the model ordinance, making a recommendation with three or four suggested criteria. And these may include, but are not limited to, the following criteria, which you can see in front of you, basically how the ordinance would pertain to Oregon's building codes and Oregon's night sky. Section 3 just explains the format and the broadness that the report will be released to the public and to the members of the Legislative Assembly. And the act is repealed in 2012. If there's no model lighting ordinance by then, we'll have to take this issue back up with the future legislature, like the 77th Legislative Assembly. And that is the amendment.
And Energy says there's no fiscal on this because they're planning on doing this. And they have staff review.
Great. What I'd like to do now is bring up the Department of Energy, actually, and I don't know if Betty Merrill is here or somebody else in the Department of Energy. Mr. Graney? We've got the director.
Expecting somebody
else, but I'd be happy. Okay. You know everything about every program that you have, so you know you're very...
That's enough to be dangerous. Good afternoon. Mike Graney for the Department of Energy. Madam Chair, we can do this study within our existing resources, and we'd be happy to do that.
Do you have any comments on the amendments, or?
Well, I think you know, as Representative Greenlick explained, the issue it is becoming an issue of more general interest. There have been lots of improvements in lighting technologies, and we can certainly look at what those improvements are and the options for that as part of the study.
Any questions for either Representative Greenlick or for the department before we bring up a few more witnesses? I think Representative Burley has a question.
We've got more witnesses?
We do. We have about four more witnesses.
American League of Oregon Cities.
Amanda Rich from the Special Districts is coming.
Okay, I'll wait then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody on this end? Okay.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up Jim Benya, George Roth, and Steve Spitolsky. He's trying not to massacre your name there.
I saved him.
Seeing that I have a challenging name, I'm quite sensitive to that. And we have three people there. So.
George is not here.
Okay. Then actually, is Amanda here? Why don't you all come up? And that's who we have signed up, actually. So please state your name for the record and whoever wants to go first.
Steve Spitolsky, Cascade Lighting Representatives.
Jim Benya, Benya Lighting Design, West Lynn.
Amanda Rich, representing the Special Districts Association and the Oregon Recreation and Park Association.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was unaware of the amendment to this bill when I came with George Roth a few weeks ago to talk to Representative Greenlit. The bill as written personally scared the daylights out of me because it would be extremely difficult for any outdoor lighting to exist by the description of the bill. A little background about myself. I'm a member of the IESNA and a member of the Roadway Lighting Committee and the Outdoor Environmental Committee, so I have a lot of experience in this field, and I know that Jim is on the model lighting ordinance that's being drafted by IESNA and the International Dark Sky Association, and feel comfortable that what would come out of that study by the Oregon Department of Energy would be a much more productive way to approach the problem of outdoor lighting and wasted energy. The bill needs to take into account a couple other things too, I think. Personal safety, traffic safety, and things of that nature where the public's lives could be endangered. And I appreciate dark sky a lot, but to lose lives over the ability to see the sky, I'm not exactly sure that the trade-off is worth it. And that's really all I have to say right now.
Thank you. And can you please repeat your name for the record, please?
My name is Jim Benya, and I'm a lighting consultant from West Lynn. A couple other important points, I think. First of all, I am the chairman of the International Dark Sky Association Illuminating Engineering Society task force for the model lighting ordinance. So I actually know quite a bit about what's being written, and I can share any of that with you if you'd like. I also serve as a member of the board of directors of the International Dark Sky Association. I've been working on these sorts of issues for a number of years, and it's my principal job on the board to represent those interests in committees like the one with the IES that's working on the model lighting ordinance. Something else that may be of interest to you is I've been working on interim ordinances for the cities of Wilsonville and Lake Oswego for about a year and a half now. They're based on the philosophies of the model lighting ordinance, but the model lighting ordinance will not be actually published and available probably for several months yet. And both cities were anxious to get something on the books and to start the process of getting control over outdoor lighting. So I come from that kind of background. Comment or two about this. First of all, I'd like to support Steve's point about the model lighting ordinance is designed to address lighting on public, or excuse me, on private property. And it's not designed to deal directly with roadway lighting and some of the other things, which is Steve's area of expertise. There will be additional information provided in the future about that from the same groups that are developing this one right now. So this is really aimed at, in other words, any lighting that's on private property, parking lots, private roadways, et cetera. But it's not, the model lighting ordinance will not be addressing street lighting directly, not yet. The other thing you need to know probably is that there will also be a follow-up, probably a model sign ordinance that will come out of a similar group in the next year or two. Part of the problem we have now is that the first and largest cause of light pollution is street lighting, and the second largest pollution cause is signs. And so between the two, some additional work needs to be done. The Illuminating Engineering Society of North America, I'm the chairman of the Board of Fellows of the organization this year. We will be providing additional information as it becomes available from the research and work that's being done in the IESNA. So that work is, of course, obviously it's publicly available. It's available to you. And as a citizen of Oregon, I'm here to help you as much as you need in taking this research and this work further into our own state law. Final comment is I would love to see this model lighting ordinance be adopted into a state law. We would be leaders in the country, if not in the world, in doing this, especially if we do it correctly and we do it in conjunction with the IESNA and the International Dark Sky Association. Many of the concerns Steve expressed, because this is a joint document of IESNA, which publishes all of North America's standards for lighting, it will not preclude proper, safe, or appropriate lighting. That's one of the keys to the reason why the model lighting ordinance should be used as opposed to any other basis. And I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to be clear for folks in the audience, if you haven't looked at the amendment, that this amendment does not say that the state would adopt model ordinance. It just says the Department of Energy would review and look at what's out there and then make recommendations in the next legislative session. So
Madam Chair, if I could make one final comment. I've worked with the Department of Energy on a number of situations over the last dozen or so years, and they're a great group, and I have all the confidence in the world. They're an appropriate group to do this research. Thank you.
Thank you. Amanda?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here representing the Special Districts Association and the Oregon Recreation and Parks Association. Our main concern with the bill was maintaining the ability to provide security for our buildings and our facilities, so the security lighting around things like water reservoirs, other facilities that we maintain, and then also public safety, things like lighting on trails, lighting in areas where it's necessary to public safety on public property to keep well lit. So obviously, the Dash 1 amendments alleviate our concerns. I just hope, and I don't know if I should be addressing these comments to you or to the gentleman sitting next to me. I would just hope that the ordinance, now he has said that it won't apply to publicly owned land, correct? And I suppose that would address our concerns, but we just want to make sure that we're keeping public safety and security issues in mind as we go forward on this.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Berlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to hear from the League of Oregon Cities and the counties, too, for that matter, because we went through this debate in Bend. Somebody brought forward a local ordinance for lighting because, you know, we've got the observatory about 20-some miles east of town. And it gets nasty in a hurry. It really does. And I'm a little bit nervous about, you know, establishing some sort of an outdoor lighting standard statewide. That makes me a little nervous. But the thing about this draft as it's currently drafted right now, this Dash 1 amendment, is that it's telling local building officials they have to go do this study as well. So the Department of Energy may have it in their budget to make that assessment, but I question whether or not all the local governments have the ability to meet this as well. So I'd like to hear from the League of Oregon Cities at some time about this.
Okay, thank you. I did see Willie Tiffany outside, but he may be in the hall. Let's see if we can track him down. Any other questions, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just more of a comment. I have to tell you, until this bill was brought forward, I never even thought about this, and I guess this shows the diversity of our state. As a legislator who comes from rural eastern Oregon, I guess I just take the stars and the and the moon for granted. I can walk right out my front porch and look up, and there they are. You know, a community that has taken a concern about the lighting surrounding them, the Sun River. And Sun River has done a magnificent job in making sure that safe, efficient, effective lighting is available, while at the same time making sure that it's not excessive or non-efficient. And so I'll be giving a yes vote to this today. It's a study. We'll be looking at it. There's no fiscal on it. And again, it shows the diversity in our state. I would never have thought of this issue. So thank you, Representative Greenlick, for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Any other questions for this? Any other questions for this panel? Okay. I see that Willie Tiffany from the League of Oregon Cities is here. Willie, would you like to come? There's been a request. He's like, not really.
Sorry, Willie.
Thank you, gentlemen and ladies. We have the Dash 1 amendments, which I know you have in your hand right now, to House Bill 2628. Have you had a chance to look them over?
Madam Chair, Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. My 30-second review is my extent of my knowledge of this bill. I believe the question is about Section 1. Is that correct, Representative Burley?
Yes.
Upon reading that, I think local governments, both cities and counties, would agree to work with the department on the study versus be required to do an independent study, if that works for the committee.
And I just want to see a nod from the Department of Energy and also with the Association of Counties, which I don't know if we have guests.
Great, thank you.
Doris is here. So I was going to specifically request that they would like to speak on this bill. Okay. That you work with all the folks, you know, that we're hearing from today. And we do have a Douglas County Commissioner. Would you like to come up and state your name for the record? Thank you, Willie. Appreciate it.
Marilyn Kimmelman, Douglas County Commissioner. I didn't come today to testify on this. I'll be up on another one, but I'd be happy to weigh in. I did glance at it. You know, and I've got to agree with Representative Smith in the fact that we can look up and see the stars, but I've got to disagree on moving it forward. This is a baby step to regulation, as we all know. Everything comes incrementally in little bitty steps. Let local governments handle it. If they don't have a problem, they don't need to address it. If these guys have a problem, they need to work with their local government and come up with a solution to their problems. But to do this broad brush of, we've got to do a study, it's just going to be a study. We know where that goes. And so I'm very concerned about where this goes. I'm very concerned about safety. There's a reason why when you're in the country, you don't have lights. There's a reason why when you're in the city, you need them. And there is a big safety issue. So I just would be concerned about where this goes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to follow up on my comments. Mm-hmm. No disagreement with the county commissioner. What I'm hoping that'll come out of this is useful information that local government mm-hmm. may be able to glean that they otherwise wouldn't. And so, again, I don't see a fiscal cost on this, and you know, the state and the communities are willing to work together on this, and so I just don't see the downside.
Great, thank you. Representative Burley?
And also, just again, to highlight the fact that this bill in and of itself does not set any standards. It's just asking to do the assessment. So
correct.
I think based on what I've heard, I'll support this bill and look forward to seeing the study, but I must say ahead of time that any statewide standards on something like this I would resist very strongly, but... it is a problem. I know that. I'll support it.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, anybody else would like to come up and testify on this bill? Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2628, and I will open up a work session on House Bill 2628 and entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2628.
Okay. Representative Cannon has moved adoption of the dash one amendments for House Bill 2628. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries.
And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2628 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2628 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byer, excuse. Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair
Dinkle? Aye. And the motion carries. And I will ask Representative Greenlick if you'd like to bring this to the floor, since I know you've been working on this for several years and appreciate your hard work on it.
Create a planetarium display for the ceiling. of
That would be a welcome.
What would I have to ask for permission to do that?
Weather to
Thank
cooperate.
Thank you very much, committee.
With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2628. And I will open up a work session now on Senate Bill 8. I'm sorry. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 838. And we have a whole list of people who were not able to testify because we ran out of time on Wednesday. So we're going to start with that list. And also just a reminder that we are limiting testimony to 3 minutes because we want to make sure to try to get everybody in today. Okay. I will call up Jeff Hammerlin. Is Jeff here? These are folks who were left over from last time. Fred Hewitt? Is Fred here?
Fred.
Oh, and Jeff. Here you go.
Call me?
Yes.
Okay, we were outside.
Sorry. Jeff and Fred. Could you come up, please? And then is Tom Wolf here today? Yeah? Tom? Hey. Sorry, I'm having a hard time seeing you in the out there. And Tom, why don't you get started, and if you can say your name for the record, appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Chair Dingfelder, committee member. My name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited is the largest cold water conservation group in the United States with 160,000 members nationwide and 4,000 here in the state of Oregon. We first of all, I want to say that supporting renewable energy is a vital part of the mission statement and conservation plan of Trout Unlimited, so we support wholeheartedly Senate Bill 838A. We believe it's a step in the right direction, and believe that all the work that's gone to it is a way to go make sure that we continue to have renewable energy that is less harmful to our environment. Having said that, we have some concerns about the hydroelectrical part of the program. We feel that it's too broad and will allow some new dams and diversions on many of the Oregon's waters as renewable energies. Water Watch will be coming up to give a more complete testimony, so I'll leave a lot of that to Dave Moskowitz to go more clearly into that in the interest of keeping my testimony brief. But we suggest that a new amendment be added that would deal with limiting hydroelectrical development and making sure that there's no provisions allowed in here that would allow new hydroelectrical development as part of this bill. So we believe that renewable standards can be met without the broad strokes that this bill has now. So we support an amendment. Water Watch and other groups will be giving a more detailed view of that amendment. Then I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I will be calling them up later, testimony. Jeff, welcome. Jeff, my constituent, I appreciate you coming back after being here and waiting patiently the other day.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Hammerland, and I'm wearing a couple of hats here. I guess the primary one for the purposes of this testimony is a professor at the Mark Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. I teach graduate courses there on Northwest energy policy. I've had the honor of doing that with one of my heroes and mentors, Senator Hatfield, for many, many years when he was, and he's actually going to come back and do it again this time. I'm delighted with his health being a little precarious, but he really wants to do this. I've also, for many years, was the senior policy analyst and governmental affairs director for the Public Power Council, which is the trade association of the 120 consumer-owned utilities, not only in Oregon, but in Washington, Idaho, and Montana. And I never represented them or lobbied for them here in Salem, but I would do so in Congress. So my job was at the national level. I'm also on the board of the Interfaith Global Warming Steering Committee, and which is supported largely by the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and many other faith-based groups. Their representative could not be here today, and they asked me if I could deliver their testimony to you as well, written comments, and so you have it there as well. So what I'm going to be talking about here is the issue of an issue that really hasn't been addressed yet in these hearings. There's a lot of good reasons to talk about it in support of 838, but here's a kind of an unusual one that came to my mind when I've heard the public power concerns in this 2 days ago in the Senate as well. As you know, under federal law, hydropower generated by the 31 federal dams in the Columbia River Basin is sold by BPA to Northwest consumer-owned utilities and to the region's investor-owned utilities and small farm customers at cost. It's sold at cost rather than at market-based rates. That has been something that has been absolutely critical to the Northwest economy for many, many years. Low-cost power is the region many businesses and industries have moved here. It's the region a lot of rural co-ops have been able to struggle through very hard times, and is key to our financial security. Not surprisingly, that low-cost power has been the subject of great jealousy from other parts of the country. And there are two groups that are particularly concerned about our low-cost power. One group is called the Northeast Midwest Coalition. It's actually a coalition of 160 representatives in Congress and 40 senators from the Northeast Midwest states. They are staffed by a very well highly professional organization called the Northeast Midwest Institute. One of the things that they do is argue through every way they can that we don't deserve what they call a subsidy, this federal subsidy of low-cost power. And the way they do that is by finding examples that they can point to here in the Northwest where they believe, and they believe that members of Congress from other parts of the country would agree with them, where we are basically appearing to be stingy or not picking our role seriously in terms of addressing major public policy problems. The issue that they are focusing right now, the most important issue that they're focusing on right now, is how well we are performing in the Northwest on our BPA and our utilities, consumer utilities, in the area of addressing global warming and climate change issues. So I bring this up because when we they take things out of context, they kind of twist things around, and they produce these things like Rethinking Bonneville, why PPA must be reformed, Federal Power Dinosaurs. And what they do is they take the information from things like these hearings, if it's on the public record, and argue that, you know, our public power utilities in the Northwest aren't taking the responsibilities of global warming seriously. All right.
I was going to say you have about 20 more seconds,
okay.
So you may want to start wrapping up.
All right. So my biggest concern is that every president has done this ever since Ronald Reagan, when I represented them in this issue. And I was very, very pleased when groups like the Washington PUD Association decided to support Washington State's version of the Renewable Portfolio Standard. And I was very, very pleased to hear what the Oregon Municipals decided to support it. And I'm very concerned that the co-ops and the PUDs, even though I believe their sincerity, and I certainly believe their concerns about local control, which I share, that they need to consider the long-term implications of not contributing, belling up to the bar, if you will, and addressing global warming by participating in the renewable energy standard. I guess I'll leave it at that. I'll just say that I have some examples of cases, you know, in the past where utilities, how public power utilities have done relative to investor-owned utilities in the area of energy conservation and in the area of low-income energy assistance. Two other examples that the Washington the Northeast Midwest Coalition are looking at and trying to make the same case.
Thank you. Fred.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Fred Hewitt, representing the Sierra Club. In 2005, the Sierra Club made a national conservation initiative, adopted several national conservation initiatives. The most, the top priority one is what we call sustainable energy solutions. And we're here today to say that Senate Bill 838 is exactly that. It's a sustainable energy solution. In my personal view, in my experience, this is the most important bill we've had on renewable energy since the 1981 session, when Governor Attia proposed and the legislature passed several bills relating to renewable energy coming from the work of the Alternate Energy Development Commission. Senate Bill 838 will channel investment into our coastal farm and ranch areas and create quality jobs, stabilize energy costs, and dramatically increase energy self-sufficiency. And it will also protect our land, air, and water while reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Developing renewable energy also requires careful attention to how the sources and the sites where it is done. And we have two particular concerns we want to draw to your attention in this regard. First, on hydro, we think that the language in the bill at present really provides very good protection, and we encourage you to continue with that. We would support the language being proposed by some of the other hydro-oriented organizations concerning new impoundments and diversions, because that would add the final increment that I think would be helpful to protect our rivers and fish. On the issue of woody biomass, which has been brought up several times in the testimony, we support the current language and think that including of small diameter materials around forested communities where the natural fire cycle has been suppressed and fire is a significant problem in this state, that removing those materials and converting them into energy through appropriately scaled local projects is a good thing. So we also think that Senate Bill will improve forest practices, community safety, and economic stability in our rural areas while providing an important new source of energy for our entire state. The thing that personally really attracts me about this bill in a big way is that the support it's received and the readiness of the entire state to move forward on this is very heartening. This is a chance for us, as an Oregonian, I really believe this, to move forward all parts of the state, all sectors of the economy, to do something that's really going to be beneficial to our state as well as achieve our responsibilities to protect the environment. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for this panel?
Just a quick comment to Professor Hammerlund, and a note of appreciation. Sometimes on a bill like this, you think you've heard it all. It's been in the building for so long, and we've taken testimony, and I was at some of the Senate hearings. So I appreciate the sort of national perspective that you've brought to this, which isn't one I've heard before. Thank you.
Thank you, and it was obviously a concern that Senator Durfler had when he was Senate president, enough that he made this a very important issue when he was here.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment also with respect to the professor's testimony, which I thought was rather also rather intriguing. But I would also submit that if in fact, you know, one of our ultimate objectives here is to deal with the emission aspect of this, we should be rewarding, not penalizing, the hydro operations. You're not going to get any more emission-free power than that.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming back. Appreciate it. Okay, next I'm going to call up John Charles and Link Cannon. And also want to mention, there's a sign-up sheet there. I just got a note. There were a couple other people who wanted to testify. I'm going to ask if you want to testify, we'll be able to probably take a few more comments. So please sign up at that sheet so we have the spelling of your name correct. And we'll keep moving at 3 minutes. And actually, I'm going to call up also Jim Welsh on this panel. Jim was here and graciously took his name off and said he could come back.
Madam Chair, my name is John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. And I have a lot of concerns with this bill. In fact, I think it's one of the greatest intellectual frauds of recent history in Oregon. It's going to take billions of dollars from most people who are not represented in this room, ratepayers, and transfer it to a small group of politically correct utility executives and lobbyists. And I would start by saying it starts with the lack of honesty in the definition of renewable energy. You've heard this from other people. You cannot have credibility with the public when you just have this Orwellian definition that converts renewable to not renewable. So the easy solution, call what's obviously renewable, renewable, and if that means you want to raise the mandate from 25% to something higher, 50, 75, or whatever, I would still disagree with the mandate, but at least you would be recognizing that, as Representative Burley was talking about, you know, main stem dams on the Columbia are pretty renewable and they're pretty carbon-free. Is it lack of need for this is another concern. I mean, Oregon already has one of the least carbon-intensive economies in the whole country. I have several data sets there, whether it's the Energy Information Administration that ranks us as 48th least in terms of power produced, or ODOT's definition that in terms of power purchased. We're getting at least 49% of our power from non-carbon sources, so it's not like we have a rush to judgment with some crisis here. Third, and this is one of my key points, I guess, this is unnecessary because Oregon consumers, most consumers already have the opportunity to participate in voluntary green pricing programs, and we have some of the most successful in the country, although even at most successful, you can see that roughly for 60 consecutive months, in many cases, consumers have been voting over and over and over, about 95% or more, not to do this. So I'm wondering why you want to force them to do something that they keep saying they're not interested in doing. And then, ironically, despite the fact that our green power programs are among the most successful in the country, Section 23.2 of the bill will disqualify electricity under those power programs for qualifying for compliance with the bill. So these early adopters could just get punished, and I don't see why there would be any more green power programs anyway if this passes. So my next point is that this is obviously not going to be good for ratepayers, although people keep talking about it as if it is. The price differential for green power programs across the country has been 2 cents per kilowatt hour steady for the last 6 years. It's not going down. it's wonderful that ratepayers can opt into this, but this is going to force them to. An issue that has not been talked about much has to do with these renewable energy certificates. It was not discussed at all in the Senate, and I think there's a good reason why. I think it's a bit of a scam. I have some language here in page 5 directly from EWEB's website, and it talks about how, they don't need this green power. They buy it out of state. If they actually brought it to Eugene, it would force the displacement of low-cost and primarily renewable power from BPA system. So It says here, if you buy EWEB Green Power, the utility will match your purchase kilowatt hour for kilowatt hour by retiring these RECs from renewable energy projects. And I'm still trying to figure out, like, what are these things? So as far as I can tell, a well-intentioned EWEB customer who signs up for 100% green power pays roughly $10 extra for power that EWEB doesn't need and therefore sells, but EWEB promises to retire some portion of the, quote, environmental attributes that exist only as a theoretical construct that can't actually be measured. Meanwhile, 96.6% of EWEB's main power supply is derived from non-carbon sources anyway, which means EWEB's expensive green power is irrelevant.
John, since we have your written testimony and you're out of time, can you wrap up, please?
Sure. I just think those sections, 14 through 18, especially with RECs, you need to really discuss those and make sure you can explain them to your constituents, because I think they're very opaque. They create essentially a bogus market. I think this deserves a lot more time than it has gotten so far in actual work sessions in this building.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Mr. Welsh.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And we certainly have a number of concerns. A lot of those concerns have been expressed after hours and hours of testimony. And a lot has been said. We noticed and representation from the eastern counties about the benefits, economic development benefits, the installation of wind generation and everything is very positive for the counties. And we listened to a lot of that, and we were concerned that a lot of that did not include the discussion of where the ratepayers came in on this. And those are our concerns and our kind of our format that we also provided some written testimony there. And in short, I'll just cover that, but that a lot of the concerns have been expressed. But we also know the hype around this excites not only those, a lot of Oregonians and businesses and industries, individuals throughout this the state, but across the nation also. But this hype is kind of glossing over some of the realities, we think, and some of the concerns that could come home to roost in the homes of the ratepayers. And we have to be very careful that they are protected. Big concern that we heard about is certainly about the rate cap, certainly compared to a cost cap. And those concerns, you know, as we establish something and change something here for the 60% of the people covered by PGE and PacifiCorp, somewhere around 60% of the ratepayers in the state. And we're concerned there, but we also heard from PUC Commissioner Beyer that they would take care of some of those things. Okay, that's fine. But we also believe that we should really question the automatic adjustment clause. You know, there's the ratepayers again have to be considered here. They'd be deprived of the opportunity to review and challenge a utility's cost, okay? Very meaningful to ratepayers again. And that's a lot of our people are served by PacifiCorp down in the southeast corner of our state and across the state. So this is meaningful to us. And an off-ramp provision or multiple off-ramp provisions here that will protect, you know, the service quality, reliability, integration, the supply and cost of renewable resources. You know, we need the protection again because it's going to be uncertain. This is speculative at best. What is going to be here in the future? We know prices are going to go up around anything probably associated with petroleum. But what we're doing here is speculative in the renewable industries, too. And we don't want the hype to overcome honesty and good study. And we don't believe that it's important, this important, to mandate this on the ratepayers. And these mandates could be reduced or eliminated and let the market take over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Welsh. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lincoln Cannon. I'm here representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council. You have my testimony. I will not read it to you, and I will skip over the first part of it, except to say that OFIC shares the concerns expressed by Jim and John both. They've been raised and discussed in some detail in this committee by ICNU, AOI, and others regarding the cost cap, the material adverse impact off-ramp, and the potential cost of the automatic adjustment clause in particular. The two issues I've raised here in my testimony that are most specific to our interest are the first, the pre-1995 cutoff date for renewable energy. I've attached two pieces to this. The first one is a graph of hydropower produced in the 50 states, 50 United States, and Oregon, as you can see, is number three in the country. And with reference to Mr. Charles' testimony, I guess the question is, if Oregon is already a major producer of green power, shouldn't or renewable energy, shouldn't that be taken into account in crafting a renewable portfolio standard? It doesn't make sense to us to leave that out. The second page is a map from a study done. I think I'm too close. A study done by the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. It shows bioenergy and cogen facilities in Oregon. There's over 55 of them. 12 of them are cogen, which most of them produce steam for industrial processes, but cogen facilities produce steam and electricity. And most of these, there are several new ones that are coming online now, but most of these would be left out. And Senator Ferrioli, I believe, has proposed an amendment to address that, but which would be an improvement, but we still believe the hydropower and other renewable resources ought to be considered. The main point I wanted to get to was the woody biomass definition, and we believe that's just basically dysfunctional. Says that woody debris from harvesting or thinning conducted to improve ecological health and to reduce uncharacteristic stand replacing wildfire risk. To us, that means electricity generated from woody biomass from federal forest restoration projects. That eliminates or excludes any slash logging slash biomass produced by from private lands as a result of timber harvest activity, which is 90% of the timber harvest in the state comes from private and state lands. It also excludes...
Can you explain that again? I don't understand what you just said about it, the exclusion. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but sure. I really want to understand that.
Okay, I'd be happy to reiterate. I'm trying to go fast and be clear at the same time.
Right. So. We can. Why don't you just finish, and then we'll have you go back as a question.
Okay. So we believe that definition excludes any logging slash from commercial timber operations. Worse yet, we believe that definition excludes mill waste, and mill waste is the primary source for most bioenergy, biomass energy production facilities. So to us, that definition essentially takes biomass out of the equation because any biomass facility that uses logging slash or mill waste, none of that qualifies as renewable energy under as we read that definition.
And your time is up, so if you can wrap up and okay. Then we'll take this question.
If I could just, it was suggested that this is an acceptable definition by Osberg, I believe, on Wednesday. They said, well, it's in 2210, so it should be okay. Well, it's in 2210, and we were concerned about it there, but we're convinced that it worked in 2210 for two reasons. One, because there is an enumerated list of what qualifies for the tax credit in 2210 that really supersedes the definition and has a different list that isn't necessarily consistent with the definition, but it works for us. And the other thing is, in 2210, you should exclude mill waste because it's a tax credit for hauling biomass material, and mill waste don't need that because they're already there. So, and we've suggested in the last paragraph what we would think would be a correct definition for forest biomass, which is the definition from Senate Bill 1072.
Okay. Thank you. Does that answer your question, Representative Smith?
Well, just really quick, Madam Chair. And maybe someone in the audience, when they're talking, can come share with me. I don't know why we would exclude mill waste. As a representative with multiple mills in the district, this is a large byproduct that quite often is underutilized and goes to waste. And if there was an opportunity to take that mill waste and to allow it to serve as a fuel source for a biomass facility, to me that makes makes perfect sense. And what I guess what I'm hearing you say is this wouldn't be allowed.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, as we read, I would read the definition to you again from House Bill 838A. It says that the biomass that's acceptable for generating renewable energy is woody debris from harvesting or thinning conducted to improve ecological health and to reduce uncharacteristic stand replacing wildfire. To us, that sounds like forest restoration activities on federal lands. And if that's what that means, then it excludes everything else, which would be mill waste, slash from commercial timber operations, and any other. I mean, the truth is most biomass facilities now run on mill waste. That's their primary source. So if you exclude that, then you exclude those facilities. Senator Dave Nelson on the floor of the Senate in the debate on this called this the No Windmills Left Behind bill.
I appreciate that.
And I think
that's unfortunate because I think it would be a great opportunity.
This is kind of the No Windmills Left Behind and No Biomass Welcomed bill.
Are there any other questions for this panel, Representative?
Quickly, Madam Chair, Mr. Charles and Mr. Welch, you both referred to rate increases. Do either of you have evidence from any of the 20-plus states that have adopted renewable energy standards that rates have increased, and if so, could you provide it to the committee? Because I have not seen that data.
No, Mr. Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I haven't really concerned myself with other states. I've mostly looked at this bill and what it's likely to do. That's been my focus.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and Representative Cannon, there was, I think, a 21-state study that showed very small increases, those increases that you would expect just over a market, a number of years of the market. There has not been that type of increase, but, again, this is speculative, and we're going into the future. We're not looking at into the past where there hasn't been an increase, and we want to make sure that ratepayers do get the kind of protection. I know that we were told by Commissioner Beyer that they felt that they had the authority to make sure that there's plenty of a rate investigation and work around that. They would be protected, but to codify language and to change the cost rate development and everything is probably not the best way to go. And the mandates we don't think are either necessarily. So if it's going to work and it has in 21 other states, then we should probably let the market take it there.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your input. Next, other folks who didn't get a chance to testify on Wednesday, Matt Wingard, Dave Moskowitz, and Rebecca Sherman. Is Matt here? No. And what about Rebecca? No. Okay. So I'll also call up Brent Foster. Is Brent here?
I think he's outside.
Okay. So if we can get him. Somebody's going out again. Yeah.
When you're ready, go ahead.
Okay. Vice Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here today representing Water Watch. Our testimony is being handed out. Water Watch supports Senate Bill 838. We commend the committee for the work on the issue of renewable energy and all the parties who have been involved in this. There's two points we want to make. Regarding the hydropower provision, other states, Washington, Montana, California, do not allow new dams or diversions to be eligible to be counted as renewable under the RES programs. Oregon is heading down a path that's different, and that concerns us. Nothing in the bill authorizes these dams. And what it does, what the program does, we believe it incentivizes new diversions, new dams, for the sake of hydropower, and that concerns groups that are interested in in-stream flows and fisheries. Oregon's proposed RES would incent these new dams on many streams by allowing power generated from them to be counted, meeting the RES. our testimony, we are requesting an amendment that would exclude new diversions and impoundments. And the language is there. And just to be clear, it'd be on page 5, line 27, section 4, 4 sub A, just to be explicit. This amendment would make the RES comparable to the states of Washington, Montana, and California regarding new hydropower, and would be consistent with the leadership that Oregon has taken historically and continues to take regarding river conservation, and for example, with the Oregon Plan for Salmon Watersheds. The second point I wish to make involves the issue of biomass.
Going to allow Representative Burley to jump in here and ask a quick clarifying question.
Dave, I tried to catch what you referenced in the bill here. I'm not sure I caught that on the hydro amendment you're talking about.
Okay. It's what we demand is it's the protected areas language, and I believe on the in the bill, I don't have a copy of the bill right in front of me, but I believe it's on page 5, line 27, in section 4, and I believe it's section 4 sub A, and we have a phrase that would go in at the end of that that paragraph, the existing paragraph. We would add one clause related to new diversions and new dams. Hopefully what this program will do, what we need to do is try to generate as much power as possible from the impacts we already have, and that's the idea of the incentivization. And I think some of you have seen the maps from these protected areas. The protected areas statute, those are not polygons, it's not broad areas, but they're actually river reaches. And there is, if you look in the website of the protected areas, this is from the Power Council site, there's a map that shows the areas that are not covered by that, and those are represented by these red lines. And that map is not in your in my packet or my paper that I gave you. But there's a lot of areas that are at risk, and that is why we're concerned about this, and that's why we're offering that amendment. And if I may, I know I don't have much time. I would like to make a reference to the issue of the biomass definition. I participated in that in the working out the language on Senate Bill 1072 in the last session. The conservation groups that worked on that were not happy with that language at that time. And it is what passed. But hopefully as we get older, we get wiser. We think that the language that is in the biofuels bill and that's in this bill is good. I would disagree with Mr. Cannon from OFIC that this language limits use of mill waste. Because if you read this, biomass means organic matter that is available on a renewing or recurring basis that is derived from forest or rangeland woody debris from harvesting or thinning conducted to improve forest or rangeland ecological health. And I think Mr. Cannon surmised that they believe that only applies to federal timber harvest. And I think there's the word's not even in there. I work with the forestry industry for long enough for them to say that they believe a lot of their forest activities are to improve forest health. They're always talking about how their activities are improving their lands. And this definition talks about improving lands and that wood waste from the... This is broader than I believe they say in their testimony. So I'd just like to make the point that the new definition, we think, is helpful, and we would support it. I'm going to end my testimony since we're time, but I'm happy to take any questions on either of those two points.
David, and my question, when you say new definition, do you mean the definition in 838 or
yes,
the definition
no,
that was proposed by a previous witness?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry if that was not clear. Our Representative Chair Gingfelder and members of the committee, we support the definition of biomass as used in Senate Bill 838 and think that the language that has been suggested that we go back to Senate Bill 1072 from the last session, we would not support that. We support the language that's in the statute.
Thank you for that clarification. Any questions?
Well, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative
Just a quick comment. We've spent a lot of time debating this issue about biomass and the definition thereof, and frankly, I blame myself when we had 2210, the biofuels bill, that I didn't pick up on this. But, you know, to me, the simple answer here, folks, is from a policy perspective, we should have one definition of biomass in the Oregon Revised Statute, and it's already there. It's an ORS 526-277, I believe, if I've got that correct. We had this battle in 2005. We got it passed in Senate Bill 1072. We have a definition in the statute already, and both 2210 and 838 should simply refer to that statute for the definition of biomass, and we just need to get past this point. In fact, Senator Nelson and I both signed a letter to the chairs of the Senate and you, Chair Dingfelder, and to the governor's office, and I apologize to Mr. Cogswell. I sent it to Mr. Vantoff instead of you. But I really would encourage us to get, you know, this is a common sense thing, in my opinion.
If I may, Representative Dingfelder, Representative Burley, I appreciate the idea of trying to simplify and be consistent, but I do believe that the interpretation of this definition 838 is being read much more restrictively than necessary. I think that the definition is broad. It protects against unintended consequences as well. So, but thank you. I understand your comment.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? All right. Thank you, David. And I'm going to call it the last panel. Brent Foster, I heard, was found missing in action. Mr. Scott Ferris and Cliff Perrigo.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'll be brief and back from my trip being lost in the bowels of the legislature. I guess I would just want to add to Mr. Moskowitz's comments in terms of our concern that this bill, while good and I think a major step in the right direction, could be robbing Peter to pay Paul in a sense of, to the extent renewable energy, hydropower, was a new hydropower specifically, was included in the definition of what constituted renewable energy or green power, as your average consumer thinks of it. All it's going to take is the first dam proposal to go in and say, this is going to generate green power. And all those people who signed up for green power thinking they were doing something good or thinking that they're supporting that are going to have a real problem. And as a river organization, we are actively advocating to help form the Columbia River Clean Energy Coalition with the goal of promoting clean energy. You can't just be against dams or against new things. There is some need to promote alternative energy, and we take that seriously. All our staff drive biodiesels, myself included, with that in mind. But I do think that the value of an amendment that clarified we're not going to be building new and having new impoundments as a part of a renewable energy standard would be valuable. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ferris?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for letting us come and talk to you today. My name is Scott Ferris. I'm the Director of Government Relations for TransCanada in the Western United States. I am based in TransCanada's 90-person Portland office. And we're here, Cliff Perrigo, who is a 40-year veteran of Bonneville Power, who now is employed as a consultant to TransCanada, are here to talk to you briefly about the impact of one provision in SB 838 on a project we have proposed called the Northern Lights Project. Northern Lights would be a new business arm of TransCanada that would be the development of long-distance, high-voltage, direct-current electric transmission lines, a superhighway for electricity, if you want to call it that. TransCanada is a specialist in the long-distance delivery of energy. We're North America's largest natural gas transportation company, and we have a growing, diversified power generation industry as well. And, in fact, we are currently in the process of developing what will be Canada's and probably North America's largest wind farm at the mouth of the St. Lawrence River called the Cartier Field, 740 megawatts. Our concern is that in Section 15, regarding the definition of what is allowable qualifying electricity that would allow for that electricity purchase to receive a certificate that certifies that it's renewable energy is limited only in current form to renewable energy generated in the Northwest United States. We think it has a couple of side effects to our project that is very harmful, both not only to the development of wind resources elsewhere in Canada, for example, but also would potentially inhibit the development of wind resources in Oregon. Let me explain how that would work. First of all, the development of long-distance electricity transmission lines are extremely complicated. There hasn't been a new one in the West in 30 years. So this is tough enough without another obstacle to overcome. By not allowing Canadian renewables to be counted on the renewable portfolio certificates, it makes our product less attractive to potential Oregon customers and investors. Therefore, it makes it less likely the line will be built than more likely. We've been informed by the Alberta government that there are some 2,000-plus megawatts of wind power potential projects in Alberta, southern Alberta, but the local system in Alberta, the Alberta system operator, says there's only really room on the system for another 500 megawatts. That means there's potentially 1,500 megawatts of wind that could be developed in southern Alberta for the benefit of Northwest consumers that won't get developed because there's no pathway to the market. So that's one negative. The other thing, and I'm going to ask Cliff to talk a little bit more about the science behind it, is that we believe the Northern Lights project can stimulate renewable development. Now, I want to be clear that it's going to be a mix. There's going to be some natural gas or synthetic gas cogeneration also put on the line. That's the cleanest possible carbon fuel technology available today, and we're also looking at sequestration that would make it as clean as carbon could be. But we also think it's going to stimulate wind generation because the problem with wind, as everyone knows, it's pretend to be a localized resource. And it's great when the wind blows, and it's unreliable when the wind doesn't blow. But if you can broaden the geographic base on which you use the wind, so it's the wind, if you look from Alberta down to across eastern Oregon, almost every day of the year you can count on the wind blowing somewhere. So you've firmed up wind with wind. If you can put power on the line of wind in Alberta, in Washington, in Oregon, in California, you have made wind a much more reliable source. And so it's going to make it a much more viable, reliable product that's more attractive to purchasers. The transmission line is important for Oregon developers also in the sense that while everyone is concerned about Oregon meeting its 25% standard in this legislation, the fact is all the states in the West and all the states in the nation will eventually adopt RPS. And there's enormous growing markets in the southwest United States that Oregon wind developers could access if they have the transmission capacity to do so. We're offering them a potential pathway that would allow them not only to develop wind for the use by Oregon consumers, but make it a very attractive, exportable product to a place like California, where the RPS is 33%, and where they use, on a peak period, and just on the Cal ISO, which is not the whole electric grid, 55,000 megawatts today at peak usage. They're expecting they're going to need another 15,000 megawatts during peak usage over the next, by 2020. And California candidly admits they can't possibly meet those standards with only in California generated renewables. And so they're already looking to other regions. And so our plea would be to craft a very narrow exception into the language I've submitted, a proposed amendment that just simply says, in addition to the qualifying electricity being from the Pacific Northwest, we could also add the language that would say, quote, where the qualifying wind-based electricity is delivered by a new interstate transmission line that provides transmission access for Oregon-generated qualifying electricity. So we would be committing, as we already plan to do if this line goes forward, building a converter station that would collect electricity generated in Oregon and put that on the line as well for export to other places. So I'm going to stop there because I know we've got a lot of time, but I'd like Cliff maybe to talk just briefly about this notion of wind firming up wind by having a broad geographic diversity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Cliff Perrigo, Northern Lights Transmission. We all support wind. In fact, as Scott said, part of the viability of the Northern Lights Transmission Line is the fact that 400 or 500 megawatts of that might very well be wind generation. The problem is that research on wind, there's been so much pressure recently that research is really only getting underway. And one of the things that we're finding out is that wind diversity is an extremely important factor. The National Renewable Energy Lab in Boulder, Colorado has done a number of studies on this, come out with a number of graphs that have shown durability curves that have shown that if you take wind in one particular area, the graph is fairly steep. It looks sharp, almost like at a 30-degree angle. If you mix wind from a couple of different areas in the same geographical location, that curve flattens out a little bit. The capacity factor gets better. If you mix it in three geographically different areas, let's say what they did is they used Pacific Northwest, the Wyoming, Montana area, and Nevada, that came to a capacity factor that is very similar to hydro. It also, if you took the upper part of that wind, which is very, very variable, maybe only generates 14 or 15% of the time, and you cut that off, you could end up with something that, just like hydro, you have to spill on runoff times, but it's a much more constant product. It's a product that is much more reliable, much more probably marketable, probably better for the wind generators and better for the consumers because they get the reliability. The wind generators get the higher price on their product. The other idea that seems to be coming out, and this is in its infancy, is if you use nodes. Like, for example, you had a node in Alberta, a node at the Dalles, Oregon, and another node down in California. And if the parties could agree on the amounts that they would put on and control those amounts, they could significantly increase and maybe even put a small CT at the central node at the Dalles. You could significantly increase the ability to flatten that curve. So basically we think wind generation is great. We think that the potential of it could be a lot better if we had the ability to do whatever we have to do to make it work. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you.
Very much.
Appreciate your input. And with that, and is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 838 before we close the hearing? Yes.
Sure.
You got 3 minutes. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dwight Langer, General Manager, Northern Wasco County PUD in the Dalles, Oregon. Appreciate this opportunity. I didn't know I'd have an opportunity to come to the hearing today and to testify, so I'll be brief in my comments, but did want to take advantage of the opportunity. I have with me today four of my five elected board of directors. Mayor, seated over here, if they could raise their hands quickly. And also in with us are other elected board of directors from some of our other PUDs in Oregon, if they could raise their hands. And some of our cooperative brothers and sisters, I think, are also in the room, if they could raise theirs. We are all supporters of renewable energy. However, we want that policy. We think that policy should be grounded in reality. Mm-hmm. And at its heart should be the welfare of the citizens of this state. In the Dalles, Northern Wasco, we've invested $40 million in hydro renewable projects. In addition, we've invested $9 to $10 million in conservation and energy efficiency. We're very concerned about the loss of local control, as you've heard from I believe several other people that have testified prior to myself, and we support amending that the 1.5% sales threshold be increased to 3%. We're concerned about the cost to the customers, not only in our PUDs but across the state. Basically, what this law was saying when you implement it is that all load growth will be purchased from renewables. It disregards existing hydro. For example, part of that $40 million that our customers have invested in hydro was in a project at the Dalles Federal Dam. It's a fish attraction project, which is actually a fish passage project, because that project was put online in 1991, it would be excluded. We're not a wealthy community, and we can't afford to have $20 million and the cost and operation of that completely disregarded through this mechanism such as is before you now. Conservation. All expenses, our customers are contributing approximately $400 million for conservation. It's not an expense that's recognized under this bill. We believe there's a complete lack of understanding and the need for baseload resources. I've got it in my papers at the chair that I left there, but it's a report. I'd be happy to read it, a paragraph out of that if
so
I have time.
We've got 4 seconds. So.
But what it talks about, it's the Northwest Wind Integration Report prepared by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council in cooperation, teaming with the BPA and a whole host of many other organizations, the Public Utility Commissions, and I think every environmental group in the Pacific Northwest, all state that wind is a valuable and a prudent resource to develop. However, it is a complementary resource. It must be teamed, as some of the testimony you just heard prior to me, must be teamed or coupled with base load resources. We believe that this bill completely lacks understanding of that, and that that needs to be taken into account. There's also national legislation about mandatory reliability standards.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify. We're supporters of the bill, but feel that there are some serious shortcomings in the bill, and would hope that you would take those into account in your deliberations.
Thank you. Thanks for coming here today. If you have written testimony, too, that's expanded on what you presented, please do either you can send it in via email.
Thank you. I don't have it with me, but I would appreciate the opportunity to do that.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for coming here today. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing. We will be having work session.
I just want to make a comment about the PUDs.
Okay. Great.
One of the things, colleagues, I would call your attention to, starting with Section 30 of this bill, there's quite a bit of language in here, specifically with respect to people's utility districts or PUDs in Oregon. And it does some things in there that, you know, in my own mind, I'm trying to rationalize why they're doing it. They're changing, for example, as you pointed out, the 12-month embeddedness requirements. But it also, for example, in Section 39, adds language that says the public contracting and purchasing requirements of all these various sections of the code do not apply to contracts entered into by districts for the acquisition, et cetera, of renewable energy. So I'm kind of curious, why are we telling these people's utility districts, which are, I guess, quasi-municipalities of some sort of thing,
yes,
or some special creature, why are we saying that the public contracting and purchasing requirements that apply to all others don't apply in this case?
Yes. Madam Chair, may I respond?
Actually, I was going to see if the PUC is here, might want to come up. I didn't know if they were here. If you can, quickly, because we have a whole group of people that want to testify in the next bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
See them here.
My response to that, Representative Burley, would be that under the state's purchasing and contracting law, basically what it says is you will take quotes or bids depending on the regulations that the respective boards have established, and you will take bids or proposals for products, supplies, services, and generally you're bound to take the least cost of those submitting proposals or bids. In the case of renewables, and I think the intent of the section of the Renewable Portfolio Standard Bill that you're cited there, is that when utilities ask for proposals for renewable resources, those are likely going to be some of the highest cost resources. That will be contrary to the intent of the public purchasing and contracting statute. Now, I may be mistaken in my interpretation of that. I'll be happy to verify that and get back with you, but that would be my response to that.
We'll try to get that clarified. I know, although the PUC doesn't necessarily regulate you all, it's also helpful to have them there to help interpret that part of the statute. So we'll make sure and follow up with that. So we appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 838. And we will start the public hearing on House Bill 2564. We have a lot of people signed up, and I can tell you we're not going to get through everybody today. So what we're going to do is, if we don't get through folks today, we're going to carry this over to Monday, probably in the evening, because we're already fully booked for Monday day. So I'm going to open up the public hearing, House Bill 2564. Now, I want to make sure everyone clearly understands that we are not taking testimony on the original bill. We're taking testimony on the dash two amendments. So I'm hoping that everybody has a copy of the dash two amendments. So if anybody signed up to testify on the original bill, hopefully they have a copy of the dash twos if they want to come up and testify on that. So first we have from Douglas County, Marilyn Kittleman, I'd like to call up, and then also Tom, I can't read your last name. It looks like Quintal. Okay. Why don't you come up here as well? And then also we have somebody from Marion County, Daryl Adams. Is there Daryl here? Okay. Why don't you get started?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marilyn Kittleman, Douglas County Commissioner, and thank you very much for hearing. I'm going to try to address those, and I hope that I do not stray from what you're trying to get us to focus on. I believe that water for us is going to be the oil of the future. It's just going to be of extreme value, and I helped start the Elk Creek Watershed Council. I was a founding member. It's really near and dear to my heart. That said, I think this goes in the wrong direction.
Now, are you talking about the amendments?
I am talking about the amendments. Okay. I guess it relates to the original bill as well, but I think this is kind of general comments, I guess, but I am trying to relate them, and I think that most of that does that. So I just want to say I think that there's a tendency to regulate first and figure out what the problem is later. We don't have a problem with water in Douglas County, and I hate to see us in any way put in regulations that limit the way that we can use our property. And this goes to the heart of raising livestock. It's an unnecessary bureaucracy. It puts undue regulations on ag producers, and the changes to it continue to do that. They don't make it any better. This has many unintended consequences, including the changes, that I think we need to be looking at ahead of time. This gets down to the specifics of runoff from your roof of your barn if you happen to use it for livestock water could be regulated. I mean, it's very ambiguous, and it's very scary to me that we would even think about doing this. Again, I think we need to look to local jurisdictions, look to them for the regulations that you guys are looking for. I think we need to be very careful too about the unfunded mandates that these changes could cause. Who's paying for it? Who's going to regulate it? And where does this lead to next as far as regulations? This, I believe, again, is the first phase of a real problem, and we need to figure out what the problem is. We're all willing to address it at the county level, at the state level. We're all willing to address the true problems, but let's go there first and then worry about how to regulate.
Great. Thank you. Could state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Quintel, and I have a small well that I feel is eventually being set up for a tax. Like so many things, you know, we put in metering, and then the next step is a tax on the usage. Therefore, I am personally totally against it. And that's basically all I have to say.
Great. Thank you for coming
Thank
here
you.
Today. Appreciate it. Okay, next we have David Joffs. And let's see who's next on the list. He's from far away. We have Daryl Adams, we just heard from. Okay, so there's somebody else who I think is from further away, and that would be somebody who left. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Cannon, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity. My name is David Jakes. I live in Roseburg. I am chairman of the Douglas County Planning Commission, a body that I have volunteered on for the past 11 years. I'm not speaking today officially as a representative of the Planning Commission, but I mention that just because of my experience with land use issues and impacts on our land use issues that come before the Planning Commission. Also, I'm a licensed real estate broker representing a number of rural property owners that this would have a significant impact on. As previously testified by our county commissioner, I'm concerned about the economic consequences. One of those I'd like to share with you that I think is exacerbated in our county right now with the loss of the safety net. All of you are aware of the implications that has for our operation of our local government, but it also is having some significant impacts on our economy, and we are already reeling from the effects of some rather stringent land use regulations. We believe that this particular bill and the amendments, Representative Dash 2 amendments, are going to put an undue cost burden on irrigators. And I agree with the previous gentleman who said that the original metering, the intent of this is, I think, without a doubt, leading toward a direction of regulation and leading toward taxation. And I think this is absolutely, as we're beginning to have an economic recovery in the state of Oregon, this is the wrong signal. It's going to do some serious damage to the engine of our economy. So I think that in closing, I would just say that I would like the bill itself, I know you're not taking testimony directly on that, but I'd like to see a stake driven in the heart of that thing. But on the amendments in particular, I think they are of serious concern, and I would urge the committee to take a serious look at those. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes? Yes.
I just wondered if they...
previous speaker here would recognize that the amendments are a stake in the part of the bill.
Well, I think they are.
They do replace. It's called the gut and stuff for a good reason.
Thank you. I just got the dash 2 when I showed up today, so I wasn't aware of that initially, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Jensen chaired the work group for this for the amendments, and unfortunately, because we're just about out of time, I think what we'll do is take a couple more folks, and then when we reopen this up, you will brief the whole committee on the work group. I think that would be helpful, especially because hopefully we'll have all the. Unless you wanted to just take a quick couple minutes
now. I think
you're right. Okay. So I think we have time for two more people, and then we'll hold over until I think are we scheduled for Monday. Hold over for Monday the remainder of folks who've testified. And next up, I'm going to have David Moskowitz and Melissa Leone come up, and then we'll hold over, we'll keep the sheet and hold over and have some more discussion on Monday. I know people have other committees to go to at 3 o'clock today. Thank you. And actually, well, because this does set the context a little bit, and Representative Jensen did a fabulous job at facilitating the work group meetings, the Dash 2 amendments reflect a lot of the discussion that happened at those work group meetings. There are just about all the members of the work group are in the room, and so I know that you two were on that. And if you can just keep your comments brief, and then we'll... If you want to come back on Monday to add additional comments, that would be helpful.
For the record, my name is Melissa Leone. I'm a senior policy coordinator with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I have submitted written testimony, and to keep it brief, I'm only testifying on sections 10 and 11 of the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, which direct the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to operate a grant program to provide funds for water measuring devices and gauging stations. The materials I've provided talk about how we anticipate working with the Water Resources Department, local watershed councils, and soil and water conservation districts to implement such a program. It would be a more proactive program rather than a reactive, because we would be working with water resources staff and those local groups to develop proposals to be able to use lottery capital research and regular capital dollars. We have submitted a fiscal impact statement, as I've said in my testimony, but we think that can be absorbed with a package that's in the governor's recommended budget. If there are any questions on how we would implement this, I'd be happy to answer them.
And Melissa, I just want to clarify for the committee, this is a new source of, this is not an existing program. This is a new source of funding for water measurement devices. Is that correct?
Correct. Okay. It would be using existing capital, Sheridan-Feller, would be using existing capital program dollars, research dollars, and regular dollars, but it would be a new delivery mechanism for those dollars.
Okay, great. Thank you. We get final word today, and then come back on Monday and have some more words.
Chair Dingfeller, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, here on today on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon. A lot of people during the course of this work group kept saying, what is the situation here? Why are we even talking about water measurement? There's not a problem. I have to say, I think the prior speaker from Douglas County, who said that water is going to be more valuable than oil, sets the stage for that. 7% of users are measure that accounts for about 46% of the water in the state that's diverted from the ground to the surface. There's a lot more we don't know. That's why we're doing this. We're happy to continue working with this program. We think that the Dash 2 amendments, Dash 1 and 2 amendments, which we've been talking about here, it has some elements that Water Watch supports. We think that the cost share is a significant step forward and could help us lead the way towards helping users meet this the goal of this program to get more measurement. And it's a modest start, and maybe I'll remind you about this fish screening. That was a cost share program where people who were diverting water were asked to screen their diversions, and there was money provided to help pay for that. and that has started a very successful program. So perhaps the cost share is one element that we hope some of the diverters of water will take advantage of and see as a benefit, because that's something that doesn't exist now. We're very much want to work with the people who are on this work group, and we look forward to seeing what we can do in the next week on this bill.
Great, thank you. And I apologize because I cut Beth off, because we're running so behind, wanted to walk you through the amendment. But I think what we're going to do, committee, we're going to do that starting on Monday, and my plan is to start the committee meeting with that and with that overview, and we'll have hopefully all our committee members here on Monday, except I think you're not going to be here. We're going to do remedial work with you to make sure that you can walk through the amendments, and appreciate it. And anybody who signed up, I hope you can come back on Monday.
If I may, I'd like to reserve the opportunity to testify or talk again on this on Monday as we move forward.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2564 and close the House Energy and Environment Committee, and wish you all a good weekend.